I want you to picture a scene. It's 1863, we're right at the height of the American Civil War, and we are in the North Carolina Piedmont. Maybe you're walking down a dusty red clay road in, say, Randolph County. It's hot, the air's just thick with humidity and tension. You see a man walking toward you, it's like everyone else around here, you know? Rough homespun clothes, dirt under his fingernails, just the look of a man who works the land.
But as he gets closer, your eye catches something, really small, a detail that would mean absolutely nothing to a Confederate soldier or, you know, a casual observer.
Right.
Stitched into his lapel is a tiny, barely visible bit of red thread. Or maybe later that evening, you walk past a farmhouse. It's dark, but in the window, hanging just casually from the sill, is a red cord.
To the uninitiated, it's just household clutter. A loose thread, a mistake.
But to the people in the know, and we're talking about thousands of them, that red string screamed a message. I mean, louder than a cannon blast. It was a lifeline.
You know, we have this very specific color palette in our heads when we talk about the South during the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
It's monolithic.
Yeah, Confederate gray.
Confederate gray, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
We think of the stars and bars. We think of this unified block of secessionist fervor. Everyone fighting for the preservation of slavery and the Southern way of life.
And that is the lost cause narrative in a nutshell, right? We tend to view the Confederacy as this solid block of agreement where everyone from the huge plantation owner down to the dirt farmer was completely on the same page.
But that red string, it tells a completely different story. Mm-hmm. It turns out that little piece of thread was the badge of honor for a massive, secret, pro-Union underground resistance movement operating inside the Confederacy.
Yeah.
They were called the Heroes of America, or more colloquially, the Red Strings.
And just to be clear about the scale here, we're not talking about five or six guys grumbling in a barn. I mean, this was an organized network that some historians have called the Crimson Thread of Dissent. This was a fifth column inside North Carolina that, you could argue, helped dismantle the Confederacy from within.
It honestly shocks me that this isn't common knowledge. I mean it, really. I devour history books. But the idea of a secret society of Unionists in the South, using biblical codes, secret handshakes, and running what was basically a wartime underground railroad for deserters, it sounds like fiction.
It does. It sounds like a movie script.
It absolutely does.
But it is very, very real. And today, we are going to unravel that string. We have a massive stack of research here, including the definitive work by the historian William T. Ullman, records from the North Carolina Standard newspaper, and a lot of local oral histories from places like the town of Franklinville.
Okay, so here's our mission for this deep dive. We're going to explore the Quaker Belt of the North Carolina Piedmont to understand who these people were. We are going to crack the codes. I mean, literally, we're going to walk through their passwords and their initiation rituals. We're going to look at the dangerous operations they ran, from hiding in caves to actual guerrilla warfare.
And we have to trace the tragic evolution of this symbol, because this story has a real twist at the end. We go from the red strings of peace and unionism in the 1860s to the violent red shirts of the post-Reconstruction era.
Wow.
It is a story of courage, betrayal, and really the fight for the soul of the state.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the map, because geography is destiny, right?
It really is.
We're not talking about the whole South or even all of North Carolina. We're zooming in on a very specific region.
Exactly. We're looking at what is historically known as the Quaker Belt. Geographically, you should picture the northern Piedmont of North Carolina. It's a region covering about, 4,600 square miles?
So on a map today, what are we looking at?
You're tracing counties like Randolph, Guilford, Almance, Chatham, Davidson, Forsyth, that whole area.
I think it's important to visualize this. The Piedmont is not the coast. It's not the flat, sandy soil.
No.
It's rolling hills, red clay, hardwoods. And economically, it looked very, very different from the rest of the South, didn't it?
Drastically different. And that difference is the absolute key to understanding why the resistance happened here, of all places.
Okay.
The traditional image of the South, the, you know, the Gone with the Wind image, is the plantation economy.
Right. Massive estates.
Massive estates in the low country, cash crops like cotton and tobacco, relying entirely on the forced labor of enslaved people. And that was the reality in the coastal plains of North Carolina and the Deep South. No question.
But the Piedmont?
The Piedmont was a different world. It was defined by small-scale yeoman farmers. These were guys growing corn and wheat for their families, maybe selling a little surplus. You had mechanics, potters, and a growing class of industrial workers because textile mills were springing up along the Deep River.
There's a statistic in the research about Randolph County specifically that just, it blew my mind. It paints the picture perfectly.
It's the smoking gun for the economic divide. In Randolph County, at the start of the war, only about 10% of the population owned enslaved persons.
10%.
10%. That is a stark, stark contrast to the eastern counties, where that number would be vastly higher.
So, okay, let's break that down. You have a population of people who work with their own hands, who own small plots of land, and who do not rely on slavery for their economic survival.
Exactly. And that created this massive class wedge. We often hear that phrase, rich man's war, poor man's fight, when we talk about the Civil War.
Sure.
In many places, that was just a slogan of resentment. But in the Quaker Belt, that wasn't just a slogan, it was a lived reality. These small farmers held a deep, simmering suspicion toward the landed gentry, the slaveocracy, as they sometimes called it.
They felt used.
They felt completely manipulated. They believed the plantation class controlled the state legislature and had dragged the poor white farmer into a war that didn't benefit him in the slightest.
Why should a man in Randolph County die in Virginia to protect the quote-unquote property of a millionaire in Charleston?
That was the question they were asking. It just didn't add up.
That makes perfect sense. But it wasn't just economics, right? I mean, the name Quaker Belt implies a pretty strong moral component here, too.
Absolutely. You cannot tell this story without understanding the religious foundation. This region was settled by significant communities of Quakers, the Society of Friends Moravians, and also Wesleyan Methodists.
And the Quakers, of course, are famous for their pacifism.
Strictly so. But it was more than just pacifism, meaning they refused to bear arms. They held a deep, unshakable moral abhorrence of slavery. For the Quakers, owning another human being was a sin against God.
So it's not just an economic inefficiency for them.
No, it's a stain on the soul. So when the war drums started beating in 1861, these communities were placed in a completely impossible position.
There's a quote here from the sources that I think sums up their worldview perfectly. They viewed the conflict as an inconsistency of war and fighting with the loving and quiet spirit of a disciple of Jesus.
Which is a beautiful sentiment, but you have to contextualize that. In 1861, in the South, that was an incredibly dangerous political stance to take.
Of course.
This moral foundation meant they naturally leaned toward unionism. They didn't want to secede. They loved the Constitution. And then when the Confederacy started instituting the draft, forcing men to pick up a rifle and kill for a cause they believed was sinful, that moral stance evolved into active, organized political resistance.
It's just fascinating how the geography and the theology blended together to create this perfect pocket of dissent. It's like the perfect storm for a secret society.
It is.
So let's move to the organization itself, because they didn't just sit home and pray. They organized.
They did, and this is where we meet the Heroes of America, or the HOA.
It sounds like a comic book team.
Yeah.
The Heroes of America. But the stakes were, I mean, literally life and death. When did this actually get started?
The roots go back to July of 1861, so right at the start of the war. Initially, it was just these small, informal groups of armed unionists basically protecting each other.
Kind of like a neighborhood watch.
A very high-stakes neighborhood watch, yeah. But by 1863, as the war dragged on and the draft got tighter and more brutal, it evolved into a formal organization. And there's one figure who really stands out as the architect of this, Dr. John Lewis Johnson.
Tell us about Dr. Johnson. He sounds like a character.
He is. He was a physician and a pharmacist, born in Philadelphia, believe it or not, but living in North Carolina. He's often called the Apostle of the Order.
The Apostle.
He helped establish the Grand Council in Raleigh. And what's so brilliant is how he and others structured the group. They didn't just make a list of names. I mean, that would have been suicidal.
Right. If a Confederate patrol found a membership roster, everybody on that list hangs. We've seen that in history 1,000 times.
Precisely. So Dr. Johnson and the leadership used what they called a structure of shadows. They modeled the HOA directly on the traditions of Freemasonry.
Okay, I want to pause on the Masonic aspect because that sounds a bit like we're drifting into, you know, National Treasure territory here. Was this just about secret handshakes and looking cool? Or was there a practical military application to organizing this way?
Oh, it was entirely practical. In fact, it was a survival algorithm. It wasn't about flair at all. Think about the risk profile in 1863. If you write down a list of 500 members and that piece of paper falls out of your saddlebag,
500 men hang. you've created a single point of failure.
Exactly. So Dr. Johnson and the leadership implemented what we'd call a cellular structure today. The Masonic degrees weren't just about status. They were information firewalls.
Ah, okay.
A first degree member, someone who's just initiated, might only know the face of the man who recruited him and maybe one other person in his immediate cell. He literally could not sell out the network because he didn't know the network.
It's compartmentalization. Pure and simple.
Exactly. And the initiation rituals reinforce this. We aren't just talking about signing a form. They would take you into a barn or a cellar, usually at night. They'd have you kneel. It was theatrical, yes, but that theater was designed to terrify you into silence.
The sources mention the oath. It wasn't light reading.
No, you had to swear an oath of loyalty unto death, and you sealed that oath by kissing the Bible. Now, for this deeply religious population, Quakers, Methodist kissing the Bible is a binding contract with the Almighty. It frames your treason against the Confederacy as a holy vow to God.
And the penalty for breaking that oath.
The sources are very graphic about this. The oath explicitly mentioned that if you betrayed the order, your head would be shot through.
Pretty subtle.
Not at all, but it worked. It kept the secrets. And here is the part you'll like, the communication codes. In a world where your neighbor might be the one to turn you in to the home guard, you needed a way to know who you could trust instantly without blowing your cover.
Right.
So they had a password system.
Okay, lay it on me. I'm walking down the road. I see you. I think you might be a red string. What do I say?
You might casually say, "United we stand."
And if I'm in the club, I reply, "Divided we fall."
Classic. Simple. Effective. But they had deeper biblical codes, too. Let's say we're in a more crowded area, like a market. I might look at you and just say the word three.
And I would answer, days.
3 days.
Okay, what does that refer to?
It references the story of the spies in the book of Joshua. The spies hid in the mountains for 3 days to evade capture before they could return to safety. It was a code that specifically identified you as someone who understood the plight of the fugitive, the spy, the outlier.
That is so clever. Using Bible verses that would sound like normal conversation to anyone else to coordinate espionage. If a Confederate soldier hears two farmers talking about 3 days, he just thinks they're talking about the weather or scripture or something.
Or how long a journey will take. They also had a motto, truth, virtue, honor, fidelity, justice. And they had physical signs, specific handshakes or grips. They even had gestures you could make while talking, touching your ear or your lapel in a specific sequence to signal you were a red string.
Speaking of red strings, we have to talk about the name. We touched on it in the intro, but why red strings? Was it just because red is a visible color?
No, it goes right back to that biblical literacy we were talking about. It is deeply rooted in the story of Rahab from the book of Joshua.
Okay, I think we need to tell that story fully because I'm guessing not everyone is fresh on their Old Testament history. Who was Rahab?
So in the Bible, the Israelites are approaching the city of Jericho. They're about to conquer it. Joshua sends 2 spies into the city to scout the defenses. The king of Jericho finds out that there are spies and sends soldiers to capture them. The spies end up at the house of a woman named Rahab.
And Rahab is usually described as a prostitute, right? So she's an outsider in her own city.
She is. She lives on the city wall, which is also significant. And she makes a choice. She hides the spies under stalks of flax on her roof. She misdirects the soldiers who are hunting them.
So she commits treason against her own city.
She does. And in return for saving their lives, she asks for protection. She says, essentially, when your army comes to destroy the city, you have to spare me and my family.
And the spies agree.
They agree. But they tell her she has to give them a sign, a signal. They tell her to tie a scarlet cord, a red string, in her window. It was a signal to the invading Israelite army. Do not destroy this house. These are friends. Pass over this spot.
Wow. I mean, the symbolism is just perfect for the Unionists in North Carolina.
It is. For the heroes of America, wearing that red string or hanging it in the window was a profession of faith. It meant, I am on the side of the coming Union Army. I am a friend of the North. When the Bluecoats get here, pass over this house.
It also must have been incredibly comforting on a personal level. I mean, if you're a Unionist in 1863 North Carolina, you must feel so isolated. You feel crazy. Everyone around you is screaming for Jeff Davis and the Confederacy.
Exactly.
But then you walk into town and you see a tiny red thread on the blacksmith's coat.
It tells you, I'm not alone. It provided a psychological sense of community and order for people who were otherwise completely socially ostracized. It created an invisible empire of loyalty right under the noses of the Confederate authorities.
Now, this wasn't just an abstract network. It had physical hubs, right?
Yep.
And one of the most important ones mentioned in the research is a place called Franklinville.
Franklinville is fascinating. It's in Randolph County, situated right on the Deep River. It was a manufacturing hub using the hydraulic power of the river to run textile mills.
And here's the irony that I love. This town was a major unionist stronghold, yet it was producing goods for the Confederacy.
That's the paradox of the Quaker Belt in a nutshell. Franklinville was producing underwear for Confederate soldiers.
You can't make it up.
But the people making that underwear were almost entirely unionists. The village was founded by a man named Elisha Coffin. Now, that last name, Coffin, should ring a bell if you know your abolitionist history.
Levi Coffin.
Right, Levi Coffin, the so-called president of the Underground Railroad, who helped thousands of enslaved people escape to the North in the decades before the war. Elisha was his cousin. The entire village culture was established by Quakers and anti-slavery advocates. In fact, Franklinville had the first textile mill village government in North Carolina, incorporated way back in 1847.
So the very DNA of the town was different. It wasn't a plantation town. It was an industrial, Quaker-influenced village from its very founding.
Yes. And the geography around it helped them hide. There's a landmark there called Faith Rock. It's this massive bluestone outcrop that rises steeply above the river. The legend goes that during the Revolutionary War, a Whig patriot named Andrew Hunter was being chased by a Tory, David Fanning. Hunter escaped execution by riding his horse straight down that steep rock face into the river.
Which seems physically impossible if you actually look the rock.
It does, but legends have power.
Yeah.
And the Civil War Unionists used that legend. It became a symbol of escape and evasion, and they needed it. Because by 1863, living in Franklinville was incredibly dangerous. The local HOA president was a barrel maker named Reuben F. Trogdon.
Mm-hmm.
The sources tell us that for these men, the danger was so high they couldn't sleep in their own homes for years.
That's unimaginable.
I mean, think about that. You are a farmer or a cooper, you work all day. But when the sun goes down, you kiss your wife and kids, you grab a blanket, and you walk into the woods to sleep. They were called dependencies, or outliers. They camped in the woods, in hollow logs, or in underground hideouts.
I read about Purgatory Mountain nearby.
Yes, Purgatory Mountain was apparently honeycombed with caves and dugouts. You can still see some of them today. It was like a subterranean city for draft dodgers and deserters.
This transitions us perfectly into what they were actually doing. This wasn't just a social club with a secret handshake. They were running a full-blown wartime underground railroad.
This is a crucial point. Before the war, the Underground Railroad was about moving enslaved people north to freedom. The Quakers in this region were experts at that. But when the war started, they repurposed that entire network.
So who are they moving now?
They were still helping black refugees, absolutely. But the primary traffic shifted to Confederate deserters, draft dodgers, and escaped Union prisoners of war.
And the catalyst for all of this was the draft.
The Confederate draft of April 1862, it was viewed as the most hated and visible instrument of Confederate power. You have to understand, for a Unionist, being drafted wasn't just inconvenient. It was forcing you to commit treason against the United States, which you still considered your country.
So if you refused to go, or if you deserted from the army, you needed a way out, and quickly.
And the Red Strings provided it. They used what was called the Kanawha Road, which was a route leading from North Carolina up through the mountains of Virginia and eventually to Union territories in Indiana and Ohio.
And how were they smuggling people?
All sorts of clever ways. They used false-bottomed wagons. Men like Isaac Stanley and Andrew Murrow were famous for this. They'd load the top with hay or corn or pottery and hide men underneath.
I read about the new Garden Boarding School, which is now Guilford College, right?
Yes, right in Greensboro. It actually remained open during the entire war. The Quakers there would leave food in caves in the woods for the bushwhackers and deserters to find. They maintained their pacifist neutrality. You know, they didn't hand a gun to the man, but they made sure he didn't starve while he was hiding from the authorities.
And this wasn't a small problem for the Confederacy. This was a hemorrhage of manpower.
A massive one. In Randolph County alone, out of about 2,000 men who were eligible for service, at least 320 deserted. That's a huge percentage.
Wow.
The Confederacy actually had to divert troops from the front lines in Virginia troops that were desperately needed to fight Grant or Sherman and send them back to North Carolina just to suppress these mini rebellions in the Piedmont.
So the Red Strings were effectively opening up a second front in the war.
Precisely. Every soldier hunting a deserter in Randolph County was one less soldier fighting on the battlefield in Virginia. You could argue that General Lee was losing men because farmers in North Carolina simply refused to fight for his cause.
Now, we've talked a lot about the pacifists, the Quakers, but things got violent. This wasn't all just hiding in caves and passing coded notes. Section 6 of our outline calls this the guerrilla war.
It was a civil war within the civil war. You had the outliers, the red strings hiding in the woods, and you had the home guard, the Confederate paramilitary units whose job it was to enforce the draft, and they hated each other with a passion.
I want to clarify the combatants here. Mm. When I hear home guard, I kind of picture older men, you know, protecting their towns. But the sources paint a much, much uglier picture. Who are these guys?
That's the romantic Gone with the Wind version. The reality was brutal. The Home Guard was essentially the enforcement arm of the Conscription Acts. Their job was to hunt men. And when they couldn't find the men, because the men were hiding in caves or hollow logs, they turned on the families.
This is the part of the research. It was the hardest to read. It wasn't just intimidation.
No, it was torture. We have sworn affidavits from the time describing women, mothers, wives being dragged out of their homes. There's one account involving the horrific practice of stringing women up by their thumbs to force them to reveal where their husbands were hiding.
It just destroys that whole idea of the chivalrous South, doesn't it?
It completely shatters it. You have to imagine the psychological terror. You're a woman on a farm, your husband is hiding in the woods, starving, and the very government that claims to be protecting you is the one torturing you. That kind of trauma didn't just vanish when the war ended. That hatred festered for generations.
And on the Unionist side, you had men who were done turning the other cheek. This is where we meet a guy like Bill Owens.
Right. Bill Owens represents the militant wing of the resistance. He was not a pacifist Quaker. He was the leader of a deserter gang in the border regions between counties. These men were armed and they fought back. If the Home Guard came for them, they shot to kill.
Bill Owens sounds like a character from a gritty Western or something.
He really does. He was elusive, dangerous, and a hero to the Unionists, but an absolute devil to the Confederates. He was eventually captured and lynched in 1865. His death really illustrates the sheer brutality of this internal war. It didn't end cleanly just because Lee surrendered at Appomattox. The animosity ran deep.
Which brings us to the political side of things. Because while all this shooting was happening in the woods, there was a political battle happening in the newspapers and at the ballot box.
And the central figure in that battle is William W. Holden.
The editor of the North Carolina Standard.
Right. Holden is one of the most complex and controversial figures in North Carolina history. He started what became known as the peace movement. By 1863, he was using his newspaper to openly advocate for ending the war and restoring the Union. He was basically saying, let's make a deal and get out.
And the Red Strings were his base of support.
They were his army of voters. In 1864, Holden actually ran for governor against the incumbent, Zebulon Vance. This was the big showdown. The Peace Party, which was basically the HOA, versus the War Party.
But it didn't go well for Holden, did it?
No. Vance was a very shrewd politician. He publicly accused Holden of being the leader of the treasonous heroes of America. He exposed the secret society. And the intimidation at the polls was rampant. Unionist voters were threatened or simply couldn't get to the polls because the Home Guard was blocking the roads. Vance won in a landslide.
But that wasn't the end of the story for Holden or the Red Strings.
Not at all. Fast forward to 1865. The war ends. The South surrenders. And suddenly, the traitors are the winners. The Heroes of America transforms. It stops being a secret society and becomes the nucleus of the North Carolina Republican Party.
So this is the rise of the scalawags.
A derogatory term used by the former Confederates, but yes. Southern whites who supported Reconstruction. And in 1868, with the war over and black men newly enfranchised with the right to vote, the coalition of Red Strings and black voters swept the elections.
And William Holden became governor.
William Holden finally became governor. The resistance won. They took the governor's mansion.
Wow.
They did. And they tried to implement radical changes. The adjutant general, a guy named A.W. Fisher, who was a northerner, a carpetbagger, even secretly borrowed rifles from Vermont to arm the state militia. They were preparing to defend this new order by force if necessary.
But, and in history, there is always a but, the backlash was coming, and it was ferocious.
The white supremacist backlash, the former planter class, the ex-Confederates who had lost the war, were absolutely not going to accept this new reality where their former enslaved workers and the poor white trash unionists were running the state.
This is where the Ku Klux Klan enters the picture.
Yes, but it wasn't just the KKK. It was a hydra with many heads. You had the Invisible Empire, which was the KKK proper. You had the White Brotherhood, which focused on taking over municipal governments. You had the Constitutional Union Guard, or the CUG.
What is the difference between them?
They had slightly different focuses, but the same ultimate goal. The CUG, for instance, wanted to restore the Constitution to how it was before the 14th and 15th Amendments. But their method was identical across the board. Terror.
And they targeted the Red String specifically.
They did. They went after the leaders of the HOA and the Union League, which was a similar organization. We have the story of Wyatt Outlaw.
Tell us about Wyatt Outlaw.
Wyatt Outlaw was a prominent black leader and town commissioner in Graham, North Carolina. He was a symbol of the new biracial democracy that was emerging. And because of that, the Klan targeted him.
What happened?
They dragged him from his home and lynched him right in the town square, just yards from the courthouse. It was a message.
It was political terrorism, plain and simple.
Absolutely. We also have the story of Donaldson Worth, a white Republican and HOA member. He was dragged from his house and terrorized. The violence was specifically designed to break the political bonds between white and black Republicans. They wanted to terrorize the white unionists into silence and the black voters into submission.
Governor Holden tried to fight back, didn't he? This led to what's known as the Kirk Holden War.
This is a wild chapter. In 1870, Holden declared a state of insurrection in Alamance and Caswell counties. He suspended habeas corpus.
Can you explain the significance of suspending habeas corpus for us?
It is the nuclear option in American law. It means the government can arrest you and hold you indefinitely without charging you with a crime or bringing you before a judge. Holden did this so he could send in a militia leader, Colonel George W. Kirk, to round up dozens of Klan members without them just getting bailed out by sympathetic local judges.
A bold move.
A desperate move. And politically, it backfired spectacularly. It gave his enemies the ammunition they needed. They claimed he was a tyrant trampling on civil liberties. A federal judge ruled against his suspension of habeas corpus. The Democrats swept the next legislative election, and Holden was impeached and removed from office, the first governor in U.S. history to be impeached and removed.
So the Red String's political power was effectively broken.
It was. The Red String era of governance ended right there, and the state began the long, tragic slide back toward white supremacy and eventually the establishment of Jim Crow.
Before we wrap up, there's one final bitter pill we have to swallow in this story. And it brings us right back to the title of this deep dive, The Color Red.
This is the tragic irony of North Carolina history. If you fast forward about 30 years from the Civil War to 1898, you see a group of white men marching through the streets. They are armed, they are violent, and they are all wearing bright red.
But these are not the Red Strings.
No, these are the Red Shirts, and they are the polar opposite. The Red Strings were unionists, many of whom fought for freedom and equality. The Red Shirts were a white supremacist paramilitary group.
It feels almost like a deliberate theft of the symbol, a perversion of it.
It was a mockery. During Reconstruction, Republicans would talk about waving the bloody shirt, figuratively holding up the bloodstained uniforms of Northern soldiers to remind voters of the cost of the war and the treason of the South. The white supremacists saw that and inverted it. They put on red shirts to mock that blood, to intimidate black voters, and to say, we are taking this state back by force.
So the meaning of a simple red piece of fabric in North Carolina completely flips on its head. In 1863, it meant, I am a friend, you are safe here. In 1898, it meant, run for your life.
Exactly. The Red Shirts were instrumental in the Wilmington coup of 1898, where they violently overthrew a duly elected government. It is a tragic hijacking of a color. The symbol of resistance was replaced by a symbol of oppression.
And because of that shift, and because of the lost cause narrative that took over the country, we basically forgot about the original Red Strings.
We did. History is written by the victors. And in the South, for a long time, the lost cause narrative won the battle for historical memory. The Dunning School of Historians portrayed Reconstruction as a disaster and the Confederacy as noble. The Unionists didn't fit that story. They were inconvenient.
Plus, as you said, it was still dangerous to talk about it.
Right. Even decades later, in the 1930s, descendants of Red Strings kept quiet. There's an anecdote in the research where people in the 1930s actually believed their ancestors fought for the South because their grandparents had never told them the truth. It was too shameful in their community, or maybe just too dangerous, to admit they were unionists.
We have to give credit to the man who really dug all this up, William T. Ullman.
an absolute legend in this field of history. He spent decades, starting with his thesis in 1978, painstakingly reconstructing this story. He dug into the family histories of the Almonds, the Swaims. He found the stories of men like Frank Toombs.
Tell us about Frank Toombs. That image stuck with me.
Frank Toombs was a blacksmith and a draft dodger. The story goes that to hide from the home guard, he would submerge himself in the mill race, the water channel that powered the mill, and breathe through a hollow reed or a straw.
Lying underwater, breathing through a straw, while men with guns hunt you down just outside.
That is the reality of the other South. It wasn't about glory or grand charges on the battlefield. It was about survival.
So what does this all mean? When we step back and look at the story of the Red Strings, how does it change our view of the Civil War?
I think it proves, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the South was never a monolith. North Carolina had the sharpest, most organized internal opposition of any Confederate state. It shows us that democratic values, a hatred of slavery, and a belief in the Union had deep indigenous roots in the rural South. These weren't Northern agitators. These were local farmers, mill workers, and potters who looked at the Confederacy and said, no, not in our name.
They were the crimson thread.
And that thread holds the fabric of a different kind of Southern heritage together, one of dissent and conscience.
Before we go, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought. We've talked about the red string in the window, a quiet, small signal. Today, we live in a world that is very loud. Resistance is often equated with big marches or viral posts, but the red strings remind us that sometimes courage looks like a quiet man refusing to fight. Courage looks like a woman baking extra bread for a stranger hiding in a cave. Courage looks like a tiny red thread that says, I stand for something else.
Yeah.
So ask yourself, how many other stories like this have been overwritten? How many other red strings are out there waiting to be pulled from the history books?
It's a question worth exploring.
Thanks for diving deep with us today.
Until next time.